Oh, I've never had problems doing that.
I forgot to ask, are you okay?
Yeah.
Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today is April 13th, 2015. We're going to be opening up a public hearing on House Bill 5036, Secretary of State. And I'm going to be passing the gavel back to my Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
But welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Madam Co-Chair.
Actually, I'm going to refer to Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Today, you're starting Phase 2 hearings for the Secretary of State. I believe this is your first Phase 2 hearing for this particular session. And just again, to set this in context, during Phase 2, you're asking agencies to come back to provide additional information on budget items that you've either identified in Phase 1 as requesting additional information or that are especially complex and that you need to hear more about before moving on to a decision-making process. Here for the Secretary of State, we've scheduled one day for their Phase 2 hearings, and they're going to use the time, first of all, to complete the very end of their Phase 1 presentation. They ran out of time a little bit discussing their administrative services section, so they're going to complete that. And then we've asked them to come and provide additional information on two of their more pricey packages that, well, I'm two of the more expensive packages that involve providing additional information systems positions and upgrades to two of their large election division systems, computer systems. We are also asking them to come and talk a little bit about the impact of assessments to other state agencies that approval of their budget requests would have. Both the Archives Division and the Audits Division are funded by assessments to other state agencies. So, and then finally, we've asked them to talk about their 10% reduction options. Clearly, if you want to move forward with their package requests, we are going to need to find ways to help finance those.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor.
My name is Robert Taylor. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. I have with me Chris Mullen, our Information Systems Director. I'm going to start by finishing our administrative services portion. I'll try to do this briefly so we can get to the packages. The Administrative Services Division is the division that supports the external-facing division. So we have four external-facing divisions. We have elections, audits, archives, and corporations. And then Administrative Services provides the administrative support for those four public-facing divisions. So under Administrative Services, we have the Executive Office, we have our Business Services Division, our Human Resources Division, and Mr. Mullen's Information Systems Division. So the next slide, please. The Administrative Services Division is funded by a general fund payment as well as an other funds amount of $16 million. And that other funds portion is an internal assessment of our Corporation Audits and Archives Division. Under the Executive Office, there's six FTEs. The Executive Office includes the Secretary of State and the Deputy and four other positions, and that's responsible for agency management and also other functions of the Secretary of State's office being a constitutionally separate officer. So the Land Board, accepting and filing original bills, custodian of the state seal, and the like. The next slide shows our Business Services Division. That's run by Jeff Morgan. That handles all of our accounting, budget, business and cash management services, and purchasing and contracts. And so for Business Services, Jeff's division handles all of those contracting and procurement and accounting functions for archives and audits and corporations and elections. So across the board for the diverse public-facing divisions. The next slide shows our Information Systems Division. That's Mr. Mullen's division. It includes administration of our internal information systems, technical support, infrastructure support, application and development support. Mr. Mullen's going to talk about policy option package 100 Those are the 10 additional positions, so he can talk more about his division at that time, and you'll get an understanding for what he does in that POP. The next slide shows our human resources division, and that's for fewer than three FTEs. We handle all of the human resources needs for our entire agency with that shop. That's run by Jackie Steffens. Jackie's in the audience, and our human resources folks do not get enough credit for all the good work that we do in our agency, so I want to publicly thank her for that right now. The next slide talks about the budget drivers for our administrative services division. And because our administrative services division supports the four public-facing divisions, what drives the budget for those public-facing divisions drives the budget for our internal administrative services division. So you'll see the demand for online services to the public, also impacts of new legislation, and there's always a number of recruitments and retirements and layoffs and the like that HR is dealing with. So goes the rest of the agency, so goes administrative services. The next slide talks about our KPM number 9 for staff diversity. We are doing very well in our representation of women, where we exceed the statewide workforce average. We have room to improve for people with disabilities and people with color. We are always focused on finding the right person for the job, and Jackie does a great job with that. Our next slide talks about our policy option packages under administrative services. Package 100, which Mr. Mullen will talk about, that is the big 10 FTE position for information systems. And package 102, that is for our corporation division. For accounting reasons, it gets put under the administrative services division, but that really is focused on our corporation division. The next slide is our transition to POP 100, and I will turn it over to Mr. Mullen. You've all met him before. He is been our very good and capable leader in our information systems division. And without further elaboration, Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Robert. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Chris Mullen. I currently serve as the Chief Information Officer for the Secretary of State. And thank you again for this opportunity to discuss this IT package, its importance to our agency and the services we provide to Oregon citizens. For this presentation, I'm going to hit real quickly some highlights from our first phase and how they relate to our information technology package, and then go into the actual specific positions later on. Our first chart illustrates some of the critical applications we support and how ISD is the center of that. I had the opportunity to discuss our applications in greater detail last week with the IT subcommittee. The takeaway here is, again, that each division has its own unique set of customers and its own unique set of applications that we support.
So, Mr. Mullen, just to be clear, one of the issues here is that there's not a lot of overlap, that the people who serve each of these divisions in terms of your shop can't serve across multiple areas, that they're fully employed doing just the specific area that they're doing?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that is correct.
Thank you.
This slide was part of the Corporation Division presentation from Phase 1, which shows that our business registration has crossed the 50% threshold with online applications. With system improvements, usability, with the new Oregon Business Registry application, we expect that trend to continue.
I'm not asking you this question. I'm asking Mr. Threlko, since he's in the back of the room. I'm surprised it's that low. I would think that most businesses would want what I've heard from members of the legislature who run small businesses, that to do this because it's so much easier than filing by paper. What do you – I'm not asking you. I'm just putting it out there. But because you got the slide up now, I'd be interested to hear more about the barriers to increasing adoption and what the Corporations Division is doing to partner with organizations like NFIB and – other organizations, chambers of commerce, things like that, that work with small businesses to improve online filing. So not your problem, just put it up there because you have the slide up.
Thank you. I can tell you my sister actually just moved here from New York. She went to register a business here recently, and her first thing was, I'm going to go in, drive in, file my paperwork. I said, no, do it online. And she had a tremendously successful experience I shared with Peter here a couple weeks ago.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Coach Smith.
Thank you, Madam Coach. On that previous slide, I would strongly encourage further collaboration with your small business development centers. There's 19 of them statewide, and they really are a front door to this business registry online process. And they're already excellent partners, but I strongly encourage further collaboration. Okay. And by the way, it's the easiest process in the world. You guys have nailed it.
Thank you. One of our key performance measurements is to be able to provide electronic access to public information, any data, anywhere. As this chart was from the Archives Division, it demonstrates that we've been hitting our marks. Our agency has over 34,000 HTML pages, over 6,300 PDF documents, and not just with archives, but as an agency, last month alone, we had 617,000 unique visitors to our websites, viewing over 836,000 different pages. So, this chart from audits illustrates the decrease in staffing for their division over the years. And the key takeaway here is that, as of course in any organization, whether private or public sector, as business division operations staffing decrease, it needs to be augmented through automation and information technology. The elections division, another chart, this time with elections showing the number of citizens using our applications. We had 2.1 million active users in OCVR and over 5,100 political committees in Orastar since 2007. Last year, we had over 300,000 Orastar transactions. So lots of work going on in elections. We've talked about this chart a couple of different times. This is the overview of the positions. As requested by Mr. Bender, our LFO, to attempt to prioritize the positions using the need for the positions versus the risk of not having those positions. It took us some time looking at each of these positions, but we were able to rank them. And we're going to get into each of these a little bit more. One last chart from the last phase one. Again, this is a breakout of the FTEs, the 10 different positions. Along the, the 39 positions over the top, but the change, the deltas from 1315 to 1517 in the black bold numbers up at the top. As we get into the specific positions, I'll show you how we calculated the breakout of those FTEs, where sometimes they're dedicated to a specific division, other times they're supporting the entire agency, and in some cases they're only supporting like three of the divisions, or what we call the enterprise administrator. And I also want to say, as we get into these positions, some of them will be a little bit repetitive. There's a couple of business analysts that we're getting. So I'll be talking a little bit about the business analyst responsibilities. I apologize in advance if it gets a little repetitive. So looking at the unique positions, obviously first and foremost on our list is to bring somebody, another extra set of hands in to look at security. This is somebody who's going to be specifically looking at the technical aspects of security versus the policy side of it. If this position is not filled, we will not be able to continue to strengthen our network and infrastructure work, as well as our applications. While we do have scanning tools available, we need that person who's going to actually analyze the data and help us achieve some success in the realm of security. Additional success in the realm of security. The Information Systems Specialist 8 is a systems architect. In order to achieve some benefits of the current work that we're doing in security, we also want to fortify our applications. We need a person in staff that's going to help us look at standardized approaches for how we do development. And over the last maybe 10 years, each of our teams, as Senator Hayter was pointing out, they're so unique in what they do that they've had a tendency to silo themselves. And so the code is different. How they address certain logic is different. We want to bring in somebody who can provide some efficiencies for how we're developing our applications. If you look at the FTEs, actually just overall, you'll see that with security analysts and systems architects, these are people that are supporting the entire agency. And so we've broken them out thusly. The enterprise Java developer team, as I said earlier, the enterprise team is specifically dedicated to audits, archives, and those administrative divisions. The elections Java developer will be dedicated to elections work. You can stay on that slide for just a more second. The enterprise Java developer, right now we don't have a developer assigned to the enterprise team. So there's a lot of work in archives with regards to the admin rules stuff that we've been looking at doing, some other benefits with regards to the way we do our finance transactions in-house. And right now we don't have any developer assigned to that. We have a business analyst and we have a project manager, but nobody to actually do the programming. Then the elections Java developer with...
We have a question here. Senator,
okay, sorry.
How come no developer? You haven't been able to recruit the right talent. You don't have adequate resources in the agency.
It was just a position that was never filled. We never had it in our budget. And while the work needed to be done, we never had anybody actually never had an FTE assigned to do that work.
I guess the reason that I'm asking is that I keep hearing from various parts of state government that it's difficult to recruit developers, whether it's legislative branch, executive, your shop, because of the salary constraints and the paucity of talent. And I was just trying to feel out whether or not that was an experience that Secretary of State's office was having.
Co-chairs, Senator Johnson, that can certainly be the case. We are competing with some larger corporations who are able to pay larger salaries. I still hold that working for the state comes with some benefits. We have good benefits packages, but also the ability to serve doing something bigger than yourself. There is that. But we have pretty good quality staff. The issue with this particular position is we just didn't have it ever approved as a position.
Thank you.
Going back to actually the elections Java developer, so with Aurastar, having all of those different modules, and we also have constant election deadlines and legislatively mandated changes to that high visibility application, we only have one developer actually assigned to that area. And it's, as I said, in the IT subcommittee, we've had Thanksgiving, New Year's Eve, where we've had to have staff working. They've had to miss holidays with their families due to the resource constraints of that particular team. And there's a lot of things that we want to do with that application, as Mr. Williams will be talking about when he does his elections presentation.
So let me ask really quick. So we've had personnel who have missed Christmas?
Not Christmas.
Which holidays were they missing because the need was so great?
Co-Chair Smith, Thanksgiving and New Year's Eve, the two off the top of my head. But we also had them canceling family vacation a couple of months ago that they had pre-scheduled a week to go camping with their families. We had to cancel some training. There was one individual that was going to be... going to some training or conference.
It's not good.
Mr. Co-Chair, as a previous school administrator, those are not comfortable conversations.
No, those aren't. I imagine not.
It's like, what?
Okay, going to the next slide. the web project lead. We have currently on staff a web developer, and we have a content manager, two very different positions. But what we don't have is somebody to provide some project leadership on that team with regards to initial triage to when something needs to become a project. The primary purpose of this position, though, is to secure and develop, to continue to develop efficiencies in our web presence, which is the front door to all of our applications. And there are definitely benefits, as Senator Steiner Hayward was saying earlier, to continue to look at the user experience of getting into an application. It's not just about having the data available, but does it render on a smartphone? Does it render where you can read the text? And there are efficiencies that we can build in there. Position number six, the elections business analyst. We've had a project manager overseeing Aurastar for several years, but we never brought in somebody to be a technical liaison between that one developer and the project manager. And the project manager is looking at budget, looking at schedule, but we need somebody that can do systems diagrams and database relational charts. Again, that FTE would be dedicated specifically to elections, where the web project lead would be working for the entire agency, supporting the agency. The corp application developer, the team is grossly understaffed, with only three in-house developers building and sustaining five of our most significant applications, OBR being one of them, business entity registration information, which is the back end of OBR, BIC, the Business Information Center, Notary, Uniform Commercial Code. That's just some of the applications over there. Very high visibility systems, and we have three people in-house developing for those applications. This position is currently double filled. I had to fill it. Using in-house staff, I had to bring in somebody additional to do that, which of course causes some budget issues. But for the next biennium, we're looking at doing a Berry system rebuild as well as license directory. So not having this position may cause or stop our ability to progress with some of those corporation applications, as well as, again, the security that we need to continue to develop into those applications. Part of the application development lifecycle needs to be baked into the process that we're looking at security throughout the application development lifecycle. It wasn't always that way in the past, but we definitely have an increased focus on that. And so we, again, need these positions to help us achieve that. The next position is an infrastructure manager. I currently have 12 staff that are doing networking, database administration, service desk, server administration for large-scale servers like Solaris servers and some of the smaller-scale servers like Microsoft and SQL Server. 12 people on that team without any management oversight other than the CIO. And while they are a fully functioning team, full of people with integrity and working very hard, I frankly don't necessarily always have the time to give them the feedback, the performance evaluations that really any team would require working at that level. And so I would like to bring in an infrastructure manager as we start taking on some of these larger security projects, bringing in some additional utilities to scan our networks. That position also would be spaced out and supporting the entire agency. The last two, an enterprise business analyst. While we have a business analyst on team right now, they're actually supporting five different divisions, the administrative division being one of them, which houses HR, IT, and BSD, then also supporting audits and archives. So we would like to have another business analyst in-house to help us with our security initiatives and some of the innovation that we're looking at with archives and audits, search modernization being one of those.
Senator Johnson.
I've sort of lost track along the way. How many people are we up to now?
Nine.
Well, this is 10.
Oh, yes.
10 total.
Okay. Thank you.
And the last position that we're looking at is a web usability tester. In the last few years, we've been developing applications And browsers continue to change. You have Safari, Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, although Internet Explorer is
going away.
But each of your applications can render differently depending on the application or the browser that the person uses. If they're doing an iPad or a tablet, that application might look a little bit different. We'd like to bring somebody in staff that can actually do some testing around those applications. So instead of coming to our web page where we say, you have to use Internet Explorer version 8, 9, or 10, or Chrome 5. If you don't use these, sorry, it's not going to render appropriately for you. We'd like to not have that anymore. We'd like to be able to say, no matter where you're coming from, you'll be able to see our applications and use the services that the Secretary of State is offering.
I have to say, on a personal level, I know that one sounds less necessary. I actually completely agree with that because people do have a variety of things they like to use and they get very frustrated. I personally have gotten very frustrated when I've gone to a website. I tend to use Chrome and Safari because I'm a Mac person. And when I go somewhere and it does not work with Chrome or Safari and I have to go and re-download Firefox and Explorer doesn't work on Mac platforms and, you know. So it's just incredibly frustrating for people, and that's not what we want. We want them to have a seamless experience. So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. I'm not rendering judgment yet on any of these, but I do have a question. On number 10, is that really a full-time job, 165 hours a month, 12 months a year for an entire biennium?
Co-Chair Smith, as with most IT organizations, agencies in the state, to answer the question, I think that's a question. That's a conversation I would absolutely be willing to have. We do a lot of cross training, despite the fact that you have very siloed divisions. We do try to provide opportunities for growth, and so there are other areas where this person could fill, if in the event that they're not fully occupied. I do expect that it would be a fully engaged employee.
But I guess playing on that, let's just pretend the web usability tester isn't overbooked for a period of time, but somebody on position number 4 could use some backup or cross-training so that person has the ability to go back through and assist in those areas. And granted, I'm making this up as an example.
Thank you, Chair. One of the issues that you can have in an IT operation is bottlenecking, and when you have a testing team where they're trying to turn the testing back to the developers, they find a bug, they ship it back to the developers, they find another bug, they ship it back. This person would be testing specifically web rendering, but they could also fill in on some of the other automated testing functions that we provide.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is all the positions that I requested in this particular budget, if anybody has any.
Okay, Senator Whitsitt, and then
thank you.
Representative
Collins. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mullen, the funding on these programs is about 1/4 general fund and about 3/4 other funds. What is the logic for the general fund, and what is the actual source of the other fund?
If it would be acceptable, I'd like to bring Mr. Morgan up to answer the question. Sure. I can answer a piece of that, but I think Jeff would be much better at it.
Mr. Morgan?
Jeff? Co-chairs, members of the committee, Jeff Morgan. I'm the director of the Business Service Division for the Secretary of State. The logic behind the funding on the other fund is based on our internal support assessment to those 4 public-facing divisions, audits, Archives, Corporation, and Elections. Elections Division is primarily funded by General Fund. Audits Division and Archives Division and Corporation Division are funded with other funds. So,
and the source of those other funds, sir?
The source of those other funds are Audits Division and Corporation Division and Archives Division.
No.
So where
did they get their money?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the audits division gets their money from, they assess other agencies. So there's an assessment there. Archives likewise.
And then corporations, it's through their business filing fees.
You have a further follow-up, Senator?
Yes. I lost track of how many times we're assessing here. Mm-hmm. You're internally assessing, and then you're assessing agencies who are using other funds from somewhere.
Yes. Yes. So that the way our budget works for Audits Division and Archives, we fund those through assessments of other state agencies. Those agencies then, of course, they get their funds either through a general fund allocation or through fees or through some other mechanism for their own revenue. But in our agency, it's the public-facing agencies either have an assessment or fee or general fund, and then for the Administrative Services Division, of which Mr. Mullen is a part, we do an internal assessment of our business divisions to fund that.
I think it'd be very interesting to see a breakdown of where the original source of the money comes from. You know, where not to the dime, you know, but I mean, just in a broad sense, your Secretary of State's office is a sort of a microcosm of DAS, in that it's all other funds, but it's you know, funds always have to have a source somewhere, and so it'd be very good to know where that comes from. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question has probably back to Mr. Mullen, and that is, when you're looking at your different analyst positions, do you do a comparative system with other states our size, or how do you do your research?
Co-chairs, Representative Kump, that's actually a great question. Each agency in the state, as I'm sure you know and you've seen, they have very different functions. Mm-hmm. And one of the differences between the Secretary of State and other agencies is the sheer number of applications that we're actually supporting that are public facing. We have very, very disparate groups, these divisions, that are providing very unique sets of services to our citizens. You've got the business registration, then you've got voting, then you've got archives, state archivists. So we have looked at and compared where we are with other agencies. We've also, when we look at the classifications, we look at, for example, we put a position description together, and then Human Resources goes out and tries to see what that compares to with the rest of the state. So, yes, we do look and we do compare.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that someday we'll change in education, but we always look at schools of comparative size when we look at our budgets to make sure that there's some alignment or some practicality issues that are reviewed. And if somebody else, you know, has a half-time position where another district has a three-quarter position, it's like, and then we start digging a little deeper to really if our the board or our committee says, well, how can you justify that? So I do like to know sources and background. So thank you. Yeah, I'm not good enough on this subject yet to really ask all those details.
Getting there fast, Representative. I mean, this does bring up the question, and not that it's your fault, it's just that you happen to be here. This is an ongoing concern of this committee about sort of tracking the money back and making the budgeting process a little bit more transparent. And I think it's a concern that pretty much all of us on this committee share, since we see so much that's related to assessment. I don't necessarily argue that it's the wrong way to do it, but we need to think about that pretty carefully and be pretty explicit so that we're as transparent as possible to the public. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Senator Hayward. At least in the audits division, it's done through the billing of the hours, correct?
They do bill hours. They do keep track of those hours.
Right.
Yes.
And so maybe for the transparency, the audits division, as I understand it, is working basically like a law firm, and that they're tracking in 15-minute increments how they're spending their time, and then depending on the time, then they basically bill for the audit. Is that correct?
That's one of the methods. Some agencies, yeah. It's a direct bill. Others, it's an assessment. And
yes.
Mr. Blackmore will talk about
that.
But I'm
saying there is more detail. It's just not necessarily being, unfortunately,
yes.
It's not presented. Not that they're doing anything wrong, but there is a method that goes into quite a bit of detail for the assessment. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So they don't have a baseline assessment, or they have a baseline assessment and they bill on time on top of it?
Mr. Blackmore can talk a little bit
about
the assessments.
We'll wait till we get to that section, but we'll put that on. We'll remember to do that. Mr. Blackmore, thank you.
To Senator Whitsitt's earlier point, though, there is a question of transparency, because it's either ultimately the source of funds, it's a fee somebody pays or it's a tax somebody pays into the government, and then how that rolls up into our budget in Chris's shop, and where that money comes from to fund that's a legitimate question. I'd want to know that as a taxpayer, and it does. I mean, it does get more and more difficult to track the more assessment layers you add on top of it. But that's the way our budget has been built over the course of several bienniums, and we're here making our pitch based on what we have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions now? What's
Thank
next?
You.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. We appreciate you breaking it down for us. Mr. Taylor.
Now I would like to introduce Jim Williams, our elections director. Jim has two policy option packages before the committee today. The first is POP 202 regarding ORSTAR upgrades, and then the second is POP 201 regarding OCVR. So, Mr. Williams, POP 202.
Thank you, Robert. Co-chairs, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jim Williams. I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State, and I'm here to present two package requests from our division. The packages are designed to enhance our two core applications, which are ORSTAR and OCVR. First, we'll be talking about package 202, ORSTAR upgrade. Some brief history. ORSTAR stands for the Oregon Election System for Tracking and Reporting. It began with two modules, campaign finance and statement of organization, and that's still how most people view the application. However, legislative mandates and our mission to expand our tracking and reporting capabilities have grown the application to 8 current modules and another 2 that we've identified that we'd like to add. Here are the 8 existing modules of ORSTAR. As you can see, the pieces that have been added to the original model have expanded the scope enormously. Some pieces have nothing to do with the original model. And by the way, some of these pieces could potentially be purchased elsewhere. That's a topic we'll probably be discussing more a little later on. Because of the election cycle and the significance of the 2016 elections, updating ORSTAR must be approached in 2 phases, or at least that's our recommendation. We have a short-term plan and a long-term plan. The short-term plan uses POP 200 that Mr. Mullen talked about briefly and uses part of POP 202. The long-term plan uses the remainder of package 202 with an eye toward 2018. The short-term plan for ORSTAR is just to take care of the specific needs to get us through the significant 2016 elections. The long-term plan is identified on the screen now, and I'll walk through those phases. In progress right now, we've hired a consultant who will be working on an aggressive timeline for an assessment of the application. We realize, or we request that the funds be allocated.
Mr. Williams, hold on
one
second. Senator Johnson.
Has that contract at this point been executed?
Yes, ma'am. It has been awarded. We are just as of last week. We are in the protest period of the contract, and we expect to be working on it diligently beginning next Monday.
And are there clear benchmarks and deliverables? And the reason that I'm pursuing this line of questions is that I have asked one of the other small agencies about a contract that they were doing, And I just received a copy of it today, and to my astonishment, it is a time and material contract, as though we learned nothing from our Cover Oregon experience. Tell us a little bit about what your contract looks like.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, this contract does involve some very specific deliverables. Four different steps of the contract that we're four different reports that we'll be getting from the consultant throughout the course of the contract.
Thank
some
you.
Very specific timelines as well as some specific deliverables that we're expecting. Okay, the long-term plan, as I was saying, we would request that the funds be allocated but not released. In February 2016 session, we will be provide a full report on the assessment and recommendations of the consultant. And then that would give us a full 2 years, 2016 and 17, to act on the recommendations and implement changes before the next statewide election year in 2018.
Mr. Williams, and to some extent Mr. Mullen, one of the ongoing conversations we've had in this committee has been about the relative value for building custom modules in-house for IT solutions and purchasing commercial off-the-shelf systems with minimal customization. If you had to guess right now, and maybe you can't guess and Mr. Mullen can or something, what likelihood is it that most of these could be satisfied off the shelf? I mean, I think in general, the general tenor of the conversations we've been having with the state CIO's office and others who are thinking about this is that overall, though you may not get 100% of what you want, the stress level and the likelihood of goes down and the likelihood of success goes up when you're dealing with commercial off-the-shelf systems.
Right. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that's correct. We're that part of the consultant's task that we've asked of him is to determine the feasibility and the efficiency of perhaps going outside to purchase those aspects of ORSTAR that are available off the shelf. I would point out that not all of them are, but some of them certainly are. The other thing I think that it's important, though, is that Oregon has been a leader with the campaign finance and with the origination of the ORSTAR system, and I think it's very important. That's one thing that I think that we would find very important to maybe keep some level in-house, but, of course, that's dependent on the recommendations of the consultant.
So as a follow-up then, Mr. Williams, in 2013 we passed legislation to allow state agencies that developed software that had broader application outside of the state to sell those commercially or to license them if they weren't built using federal funds, in which case they're out in the world. Is that something that the Secretary of State's division, Mr. Taylor, maybe you can answer, is considering? I mean, I would have to imagine that as other states catch up to us, they would be looking for well-built solutions.
Senator Steiner Hayward, this is Robert Taylor. If you go back, Fabiola, can you go back to the list of the eight modules?
Yeah.
So these are all modules that have been built in-house. Some of the drivers for that is based on how unique Oregon election law is, for example, around campaign finance. So that would be an area where the consultant might come in and say, that's something that Oregon is so unique at as far as what our laws are that you need to do that in-house. But there's other things in here like the election night reporting, for example, or contact tracking, where we think we might be able to buy those off the shelf or have a vendor that can go out and easily build them. Your point about are there things we're building that we could go sell, that's a great point. I think that's something we could evaluate going forward.
Might be a nice way to recoup some of our costs. Co-Chair Smith, did you have a question? Representative Kalm.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question, Madam Co-Chair, is basically to you and the process for this committee. And when we have a presentation brought to us like this, where there's eight things in this pop, is it expected or the request is that we're going to accept all these things? And do we make decisions on whether we need all eight modules or I'm looking out at how to define our responsibilities a little more clear.
Thank you. Mr. Williams can probably help me better, but my understanding is we already have these eight modules, and the issue is, are you asking, do we have to upgrade all of them at once, and there's a question about two new ones, or are you saying that you're seeing eight separate parts of this pot because of these eight things that are listed here?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm seeing this as eight separate things in this POP, and that if there's been an analysis on contact tracking, I've been, running campaigns and doing my own finance stuff for 10 years, and it's like, contact tracking? Why do I need contact tracking? I mean, it isn't a tool that I've ever used as a candidate. And so I just, like I say, I don't know where our authority begins and ends, and I'm sure Senator Witz and Senator Johnson could give me many lessons, but.
Mr. Williams or Mr. Taylor, can you help us out a little bit here to address the representative's questions? Because I can't.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Comp. This is Robert Taylor for the record. Specifically, the contact tracking, that's not something you would see as a candidate filing. That's an internal tool that we use, but it is a module in ORSTAR, and that demonstrates to you some functionality that we have added to this system over the years that perhaps would be better suited if we went out and bought it elsewhere rather than building it in-house. Now, where you started, your question about the process is a great, great question. And if we go forward to the slide talking about the next slide, please, talking about what we hope to accomplish in the 2015 session is we hope that, so on number one, we have hired the consultant. He's going to look at those eight modules and tell us what he thinks we should continue to build in-house and what we can get from an outside person. This session, we would like the $1.9 million to be allocated to us but not released. So budget the money, but you keep it.
Yeah, I understand that part.
And then we come back in February with the consultant's report. And at that point, we would come back to this committee and say, here's the plan. The consultant has said, these three modules need to stay in-house. These other modules can be purchased elsewhere. This is our plan. And if the committee finds that plan acceptable, then we would ask the committee to release those funds to us so that we would have a full 2 years to implement that plan before the 2018 election.
Okay, follow-up then?
Please.
So is the $1.9 million for the consultant, or that's an approximate figure that we would be adopting in 2016?
That was our approximate figure for what we thought the total project would be.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful.
Okay. We're good? Great.
So along with the package request, we also have an idea on a way to help offset the costs of the package, and that would be to retain the fees for candidate and voters' pamphlet fees. Currently, those fees are paid by the elections customers but are transmitted to the general fund, and if we could retain those fees, it could perhaps offset some of the cost of the ORSTAR upgrades.
Mr. Bender, do you want to add something about
that? I just wanted to mention that the materials that we've been providing to you and to the co-chairs, LFO has been looking at the entire cost of this project as a general fund cost. As Mr. Williams is saying, the elections division does transfer monies to the general fund. They're requesting that you allow them to retain these monies in lieu of transferring them, which of course has the same monetary impact on the general fund as if you had made an appropriation of the monies. I understand what the Secretary of State is saying, that this reduces the need for, quote, general fund appropriation, but since this would reduce general fund revenues, we believe that both components or the complete package needs to be looked at as having a general fund impact.
So I would agree with that, but I would also say that I didn't realize, I should probably, or maybe I learned it last time and I forgot,
that these got transferred back to general fund and corporations division. We pay for the cost of corporations division by retaining some portion of the licensure fee to fund that division and then send it back the rest on to the general fund. So I'm actually surprised that we're not doing the same thing with elections, because it seems sort of foolish to send it over to general fund and then send general fund back to fund the division, because it seems to me that we should be paying for that as much as possible with fees, as long as those fees are reasonable, which I think they are. I mean, I don't like coughing up $700 for a voter's pamphlet fee, but I should, because I'm getting a service and I should pay for it. Mr. Bender's right. We still have to consider the general fund impact if we do this, but in the long term, funding elections through the appropriate fees makes sense to me. I don't think other taxpayers should necessarily have to pay for all of that. So,
Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, Robert Taylor, Mr. Bender is correct. The net effect on the general fund is the same. For us, though, the reason we asked for that is precisely the reason you identified, and it's really two reasons. The first is it's internally consistent within our agency, because that's how we fund our corporation division, is through right. the filing fees.
And in essence, that's how you fund. I mean, it's not – there is this whole pass-through issue with audits, but in essence, the agency's getting audited to pay the expenses. Yes, that's still pass-through money, but again – it's self-funding, as it were, or to some extent self-funding.
Right. And then that's correct. And then the second reason goes to Senator Whitsitt's comment about transparency. I think there's a reasonable expectation by folks that shell out the money for the voter's pamphlet statement filing fee and candidate filing fees, that they might expect that money is going to be used to maintain or upgrade the system that they're using, which would be ORSTAR in that case. So I think it makes sense to keep those monies and put them to use for the application for which the revenue is being raised. If there's no further questions on POP 202, then we would proceed to POP 201, which is our OCVR upgrade. And before I turn it over to Mr. Williams, I just want to frame the issue this way. We've talked to this committee before about this, but ORSTAR that we just got done talking about that's a homegrown, home-built application. And we have added on to it over the years with homegrown, in-house built modules. OCVR is totally different. It's on the other end of the spectrum, where we have an outside vendor, Hewlett-Packard, who we have contracted with, and they have built it, they have maintained it over the years. So it's two different systems and really two different ways entirely of running a big IT project. And Mr. Williams has the task of having a foot in both of those worlds.
Before you start, Mr. Williams, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Senator Hayward. I just going back to the ORSTAR. So how old is ORSTAR?
It's about 8 years old.
And do we have any sense to date how much it's cost the state so far to have ORSTAR?
The total all-in cost.
Yeah, do you have any sense of how much it's cost the state so far to?
We can look into that. Yeah.
And then follow up. Is it the long-term plan is to keep ORSTAR? Is that the
long-term plan is to keep the functionality of ORSTAR. So those eight modules and what we're doing with it, we want that functionality to remain. Now, how exactly we accomplish that in a sustainable way going forward, that's something we want to get from the consultant and come back to this committee with our plan. So the functionality would remain the same. How exactly we accomplish that might change.
I'm sorry to ask you this, but so let's say we didn't even have ORSTAR. So let's say it just wasn't there at all and you just had to start from scratch. What do you have any sense of what other states do? Is it less expensive? I mean, I just want to make certain that if we're putting money into ORSTAR, that's something that we're going to keep. And is it too expensive to keep? Is it better to just stop now and go with something else, this type of thing? But do you already look at all of that when you're making the decisions?
I think that, Representative Taylor, that's something I think the consultant is going to help us with as far as looking at other what other options might be out there to satisfy, for example, the campaign finance reporting right. side of this or the election night reporting.
Okay. So. Thank you. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. The other core applications for elections is OCVR, the Oregon Centralized Voter Registration System. Currently, OCVR is covered 100% by federal Help America Vote Act funds. Those funds are expected to be exhausted at some point during the 2017-2019 biennium, with everything remaining as it is today. The requested package focuses on four areas, all of which are important to the development of the application.
Sorry, Mr. Williams, Senator Johnson.
Yes, ma'am.
The HAVA money, the Help America Vote, we will expire ours. The feds will stop giving it to any states. Are we different from our sister states, or is that program at the federal level concluded and we've spent that we had in reserves? Give a little more detail about why we won't have Help America Vote money.
So the Help America Vote Act money was federal money that was made available to us. We have over the course of several biennia spent down on our federal allocation, and we expect that in the 17-19 biennium will be the last biennium that will have our share of those federal monies available that we can tap. The money's not going, the feds aren't taking the money away. We will have exhausted our share by then.
Do you want to follow
up? So the federal program's over.
That grant of money was a one-time grant.
Okay.
The four general areas that this package allows us to focus on is to eliminate bugs and minor technical issues, new tabulation interfaces, pilot new technologies, and eliminate county payments for the system.
Which folks will remember is one of the things we talked about as a way to offset some of the costs for the counties that might be incurred through 2177.
The first area that we talked about, eliminating the bugs, currently the contract we have with HP, as Mr. Taylor mentioned, the maintenance and support contract focuses mainly toward new functionality requirements and assisting the counties in making their business practices more efficient in utilization of the system. We have continue to receive complaints about the slowness of the system and feel like that part of that is because of image storage and retention within the system. Those are some things that we would like to address with this portion of the package. Another area that we are requesting
back for 1 second, please? When you say all development hours and the maintenance new functionality requirements, could you talk a little bit about what some of those new functionality requirements are? I mean, sometimes there's the absolutely have to have and the, yeah, it would be nice. So how are we prioritizing those? Sort of a two-part question. Sorry.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward. The currently, some of the things, for example, I know recently the counties have realized or recognized that there are vendors that allow them to sort their ballots prior to processing. So rather than having to sort them out by hand, they can automate that process. Of course, in order to do so, you have to have the interface capabilities with the system, with the OCVR. So another example is ballot duplication. When they receive the overseas ballots and they have to be manually duplicated, of course, there are things that they try to do, the counties would like to do in order to improve and make that an easier process. And so those kinds of functionalities is what we try to support the counties with by making the changes that are necessary in OCVR to accommodate those changes to bring better efficiencies to the counties.
Great, thank you.
As we mentioned, some of the new tabulation and technology interfaces, we currently have an existing request from two vendors requesting certification in Oregon. They are new voting systems. And we mentioned the ballot sorters, that there also have been some new vendors just within the last year that are trying to enter the market in Oregon, and both will require some new interface capabilities. There are some new other new technologies that are out there and continue to emerge in election administration, which could further enhance the county's efficiencies. We would like to the opportunity to explore some of those as we continue to make things easier on our county partners. Finally, the last portion, last area that this package addresses is possibly eliminating the county payments for using the system. We feel like that the county payments create a financial impediment to maintaining consistent use by the counties. The counties pay the usage fees and feel like that that gives them the right to use the system how it suits their local business practices. We value the county clerks and their election offices. They are our teammates. They administer the elections on the local level. But we feel like that the state could do a better job of assuming leadership of the application and provide some training to increase consistency and uniform use of the application among those county partners. That's the idea behind eliminating the county payments. That is package 201. Are there any questions? OCBR upgrade.
So just to clarify, in essence, you're asking, saying that the general fund would pick up the tab to take the financial burden off of the counties?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to be crystal clear about that. Because, I mean, I think it's a valid thing to talk about. I really do. I think it is the role of the state. In my opinion, it is the role of the state to facilitate, especially as some of our counties are struggling, and if we can free up some of that money to allow them to deal with other core services, I think that's pretty reasonable. I mean, general fund is taxpayer dollars from all over the state, so you can make a pretty rational argument, but I want to be very explicit about what it is that we're doing, because I do think it's important to recognize that we are trying to make things easier for the counties and assume the responsibilities that I personally think that the state elections division should have to support how we vote in this state. So I just wanted to be crystal clear about that on record.
Madam Chair? Yes. The other thing, I guess my question would be, as we have already passed the motor voter bill, in your presentation here and as you're looking at some of these upgrades, what's your thoughts for that, the implications of that bill?
Co-chairs, Representative Comp, this is Robert Taylor for the record. We developed our budget independent of that bill. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and we do hope that the funding for that bill will be part of our budget and added to that. So that's where we would like to get the funding for that. But as far as the POPs you have heard about today, those are separate from the bill, and what we will accomplish under that bill is something different.
And follow up, Madam Chair. Is that something that we can anticipate hearing about in phase three before we move through the session?
That would be entirely up to the committee, but we'd be happy to talk about that.
Yeah. Thank you.
The next thing on our agenda is a discussion of the assessment level requests. And we've got Gary Blackmer, our audits director, and Mary Beth Herkert, our state archivist, and they will come up and talk about their assessments that they level.
Okay, good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. And thank you for this opportunity to discuss our assessments. The Archives Division's assessments were determined in a January 2014 for the 2015-2017 biennium. Our assessments are based on projected ending cash balances, ensuring that we maintain a two-month operating expense, and our projected expenses, which include personnel and costs for doing business, such as rent, utilities, and equipment. The 2015-17 assessment for the security copy depository is determined by the cost of personnel and rent for the space occupied by the microfilm, divided by the total number of reels to get a cost per reel assessment. The cost for the 2015-17 biennium works out to an increase of 1 cent per microfilm reel per year. The Record Center's assessment, the costs are determined by personnel costs plus facility costs, which is rent and utilities, divided by the total number of boxes to get a per box charge. And the per box charge will be the same rate as this current biennium. The Archives and Records Management.
Wait. You skipped administrative rules. That's okay. The one that I have the biggest question about.
Right.
So talk to us about why that one's doubling and why the cost was so much higher in... You think the cost is going to end up being so much higher than the estimated revenues in that case?
Okay, so the administrative rules assessment is basically the same as determined by the cost of operation, personnel and operational costs, divided by the number of rulemaking actions filed and the number of pages occupied to get rulemaking rate, a rate per page. During the 2013-15 biennium, this biennium, we stayed the same as the 2011-13 biennium because at the time we were doing the assessment for 13-15, we determined that due to a lower projected expenditures and a high beginning balance, our cash on hand would exceed the two-month operating costs. So agencies benefited with the same rate for two biennia. So the 11-13 and the 13-15 biennium, they paid the exact same rate. This biennium's increase factors in the standard rate of inflation plus the funds for 2 months operating expenses, which was based on what we needed in 2014. And the funds we have remaining this biennium plus the funds collected from the agencies in 2015-17 will be used for personnel costs of and doing business, plus the development of the new rules database, which will allow agencies and the public to search the rules, provide us with the ability to track rulemaking and the number of rules, and allows agencies to print on demand their rules and compilations as needed. So it's basically, a lot of our assessments are cyclical in that some bienniums, they stay the same or go down, and other bienniums, they go up. It just depends on our cost of operation versus the cost of the two-month operating.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I think maybe key to the increase there, I hope, is the development of an electronic database, because it's pretty hard to explain a 100% increase on 4 years of inflation. But so could you break down how much of that is going, how much do you anticipate that increase will go toward this electronic database? I think that would be, just to finish the question, I think that's very important, is that the state, each biennium creates about 15,000, a little more than 15,000 new administrative rules, temporary administrative rules, and amended administrative rules, off of a base of some 43,000, I think, or God knows how many. And so the idea of being able to actually search to find out if you're, how often you're breaking the law and in what fashion would be really good or bad.
Actually, I completely agree with that. I've tried to find rules sometimes and had real trouble with it. So,
can I apologize? I have to step out for a minute, Mr. Kutcher.
To restate my question after my tirade how much of that goes toward the electronic filing?
Okay, co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, the initial estimate that we got on that to rebuild that entire database to allow the functionality that we're talking about is between $80,000 and $100,000.
Really?
Yes.
It'd be almost worth it just to write you a check. Wouldn't it?
Okay, so representative.
I would take it.
Take it out, too.
It is very important that we modernize administrative rules. The administrative rules functions in our agency are very, they were based on print, and we no longer print nearly as much as we did, and we would like to change the whole focus so that it is web-based. It is very searchable, user-friendly, like our other applications are in the Archives Division, and move forward that the print would still be available, but it would be print on demand.
So we got a question from Representative Makinson.
Thank you. It's a comment wrapped into a question. Ms. Herkert, you mentioned $80,000 to $100,000. We see requests in this committee and also in the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Information Technology that are very often in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes to make one or two simple changes. Sometimes to upgrade a database is more like in the $1 million range. So I suppose I want to ask a probe a little bit about who's making the change? Is this, can you rely on someone in-house, or is this a contract with a vendor to help with database enhancements? I'm very pleased that we can hear recommendations from you of something that would be affordable. It would seem easily affordable to achieve really good public purpose, but I'm also wondering why it can't replicate those kinds of costs and system enhancements in other agencies.
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, why we already purchased the software. It's an off-the-shelf solution, and it's through the enhancements of that software that we can now actually streamline our whole process. And so it would be a vendor that would come in and build the system in conjunction with members of our Information Systems Division, so that our Information Systems Division then could maintain it and then provide the enhancements as we move forward if we needed the enhancements. But we already own the software, so it's just the development of the new package to make it more interactive and web-basing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Questions? All right, let's continue.
Okay, so the last assessment that we have is the Archives and Records Management Assessment, which is determined by the personnel and operating costs divided by the total number of state agency employees to get an FTE rate or a full-time employee rate. This assessment just basically reflects the standard inflation plus the addition of 2 months of operating expenses. When we went to general fund last biennium to other fund, it was a straight cash transfer without any additional funding for the 2 months of operating expenses. So that explains the archives and records management assessment. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Once again, there's a education word here. Are you sharing that there's going to be an expenditure for the OEIB board of $4.1 million?
Co-chair, Representative Comp, no. It's all it's reflecting is that. So the Oregon Investment Board had the highest increase in their assessment, and that's an FTE-based assessment, so they must have added employees. And so that's
which
why
they did.
That's why their assessment goes up, because it's a straight FTE assessment. So they're not paying the whole $4.1 million. They're just paying $1,075.
Well, as co-chair of that sub, that's really
or it went up by $1,700. Excuse me. So
yeah, so I can breathe now.
But yes.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Co-chairs, members of the Committee. My name is Gary Blackmer, Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. Let me give you a quick overview of our assessment process and where we get our money. And there's actually two sources. We direct bill some agencies, and that's based upon legal rulings on a very arcane issue around exact costs being charged to agencies that borrow money. So I won't go into the detail on why, but we do direct bill some agencies. We also impose an assessment, and those are requested based on, for the assessment, it's the total budget of the agency as one factor, the FTE as a second factor, and cash transactions as a third factor. And it's kind of, I would declare it almost like our insurance risk-based pool, because we don't exactly charge them every year, but some years they're getting more audit services than they're paying for, other years they're getting less. We do a look back each year to see how many hours we've applied, and as Representative Taylor said, we do track all of our hours. We track the hours so that we can direct bill those agencies. We also track the hours so that we can make sure that we're roughly in line with what the benefits of audits equal the amount that they're paying. Now, there's some advantages and disadvantages to both those systems. We have to tell agencies about 2 years in advance what they need to budget for audits. That allows them to be able to incorporate that into their budget if they're direct billing. And similarly, for an assessment, it's part of our price list. The problem is we sometimes get budget, or we get audit requests, or we see an audit need for a direct bill agency that we didn't anticipate 2 years in advance. And for example, Department of Transportation as well, it's rather difficult for us to come in and say, well, we're going to come in and audit you, so this is going to cost you a couple hundred thousand dollars. It's what I say is adding injury to insult from an audit, that they don't always like us coming in the first place, and then having to pay for an audit that they didn't budget for makes it a little more difficult. So that's the disadvantage there. The assessment seems to work better because ultimately we get to this point in the biennium. If we have not spent our budget, we return to those agencies a portion of what was unspent so that they get a return on any over-assessments that they are charged. So this is a time of the year when we're looking at how much we anticipate we're going to have unspent out of that assessment. And we reduce our billings. We do quarterly billings for the agencies. And we may forego the final quarter and maybe even a portion of the earlier quarter. We let the agency know that we're reducing their billing so that they'll have a little bit of extra at the end of the year. One of the big things, we want to be as proactive as possible in our audit work, so we like to be able to be flexible, and the assessment lets us be more flexible than a direct bill. It makes it difficult for us to anticipate audits in the future and charge those agencies. The Orion University system used to be an assessment. Now each of the universities are a direct bill. So if we want to go and do a performance audit in a university, they're going to have to find some money to pay for it. So those are the kinds of situations we run into. So I hope that answered the general questions about our assessment and direct bill.
Thank you. Mr. Blackmer, the Legislative Assembly, in its great wisdom, discontinued or made it optional to do end of director tenure audits. And it doesn't seem like you're doing very many of those anymore, unless I'm missing something. So talk to us a little about the importance of those. Were they something useful, the lack of transparency and just handing off to someone else without knowing what's going on?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, thank you for the question. It really is up to us now. It's a judgment on our part, and we will conduct those when we have concerns or we hear of suspicions or were specifically requested. Those are generally very narrow scope, looking at issues from the departure of the previous director to the arrival of the new director. So we're looking at making sure that equipment was turned in. We're looking at final approval of contracts to make sure there was nothing, no, you know, self-dealing of contracts to someone leaving their position, looking just to see that nothing improper occurred at the end of that tenure. Like I say, we do it on a judgment basis. Sometimes we turn it into a larger audit that doesn't necessarily look like a change of director, but it's something much bigger. For example, the State Marine Board started out as a change of director, but ultimately turned into a full performance audit, questioning a number of the financial transactions at the end of that term and preceding it in terms of the previous director. So those do occur, but you may not recognize them as such. But we are always willing, and whenever we see a director leave, we're considering that. The problem that we run into is that those are projects that pull off a couple of auditors at times when we may not have auditors to spare. So we are trying to always incorporate those into our workload. But again, those are a little unpredictable as well. And when we looked historically at a majority of those, we felt like we could have anticipated those where we thought we would find issues, because we are in many of those agencies on an annual basis when we're conducting our financial audits as well as performance audits. So we felt like our judgment could allow us to focus our resources to those that really have particular concerns.
So in your audit of the housing and community development, did that start out as a change of director audit and then go from there?
Co-chair, Senator Whitsitt, we've done a number of audits of housing and community development. Was this, we did one of duplication, overlap, and fragmentation. Was that the one? We started that just as the new director arrived. Was that the one you were thinking of? That one, we had seen a lot of similar services in housing as well as human services. So we focused in on applying a tool that the Government Accountability Office in Washington, D.C. developed and applied it in-house to the housing and community development. It did not start out as a change of director. And in fact, we think helped the new director understand what all the agency did and strategies for realigning housing services. So it was, from our perspective, we felt like that was the best use of our time on that, in that area.
Everybody good? Okay. Good. Mr. Taylor, bring us home. We've got about 5 more minutes.
Robert Taylor, Deputy Secretary of State. The last item on our agenda to discuss today is our 10% reduction. So this was an exercise that we went through when we were preparing our budget, and we tried to identify the areas that we would cut if we had to. So we'll just kind of go through the list, and the general idea was to try to do as little harm as possible to start. Ultimately, you will see that you have to go where the money is. The money is located in programs that do serve people. So there will be impacts as we go along. So the first one. We've talked a lot about how the need for the demand for services online has grown in our corporation division. We do some things to proactively help promote that growth. So the first thing we would do is no longer proactively promote that growth, let it do kind of grow naturally, and we can realize about $170,000 in savings there. Then the second, and you'll see a few of these, to cut our services and supplies budget. So we would start in the administration and go to the audits division, go to the elections division, try to reduce office expenses and the things that we do to kind of keep the agency running that way. Then when we get to the corporation division, we would eliminate the electronic publishing design specialist. That's a person that helps support that application, the design elements there. And then we get to number six. This is where the money is, unfortunately. Close the state record center. Other agencies would have to find other places to store their records, but we can realize a sizable savings there. The next one,
Mr. Taylor, Sarah Johnson. This just calls out the question of, we've got the library storing records, we've got these guys storing records, $712,000, if I remember the number correctly from the, $712,000. How duplicative is that? I mean, this is it's almost a rhetorical question, and I know that the co-chair and Representative Nathanson have worked extensively, but I'm just trying to figure out, there it is in black and white, $700,000, and are we duplicating?
Can I just ask a question to make sure I understand your question? Are you talking about duplicating records or duplicating storage space?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want to invite Ms. Herkert up, or do you want to deal with that?
We can have Mary Beth come up to talk about that. And, of course, we have a very – Mary Beth can talk about this, but we have a very specific mission to store our historic documents, and the mission of the state library is a little bit different than that. But Mary Beth can talk about that.
For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the Archives Division. The State Record Center is a warehouse to store inactive agency records at a cost-effective price until those records are ready to be destroyed. So instead of them using their office space, which is at a significantly higher rate, they are allowed to store them at the State Records Center, where they're maintained and accessed by two full-time employees to provide that. So that's what the State Records Center's function is. It only deals with records that will eventually be destroyed. It's just inactive, cheap storage, warehouse storage.
Completely answers my question.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Herker.
The so we have cut some of the meat from the bone in the first part of this presentation, and now we're going to start breaking the bones. So we go to number seven, where we would cut our auditing staff. Number eight, where we would eliminate the Office of Small Business Assistance. And then we get into eliminate notary outreach and training, and that's an important public service to train
notaries.
Can I ask
a question about that one? Every time I go to get something notarized, if I don't do it here, if I'm, you know, doing something that's not a state document that I need notarized, and I do it at the local mail place where the guy's a notary, I have to pay him a fee. It's not a huge fee, but it's $5 or $10 a signature, right? So he had to pay some kind of a registration fee, but he gets free training to do that?
Yes.
So I don't get free continuing education as a physician, and our CCB licensees don't get free education as contractors. They have to pay for their education. I understand that it's in the best interest of the state, but tax practitioners don't get free training, and that's in the best interest of the state that they have. Why do they get free training and the rest of us don't?
Mr. Threlkel from our Corporations Division will come up to address that question.
Nice punt, Mr. Taylor.
Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, Peter Threlkel, Director of the Corporation Division. A number of biennium ago, the requirement for notary training was put into law. And part of the philosophy around that, we did at the time, I can't remember the bill number or the specific session, I believe it was around 2007, there was conversation about whether there should be a fee if the Secretary of State charged a $5 attendance fee or some other fee to defray the cost There was resistance from the legislature at creating a new fee at that time. Part of the approach is really to make sure that notaries have the tools and the knowledge to be able to do effective notarization so that they're serving the people that they're supporting.
Yeah, but that's exactly what we require of tax practitioners. So if we chose to use number 9 as one of your reduction options, would they no longer get any training, or you would charge a fee?
We would need legislative authority to be able to charge a fee. We don't currently have that in the law. We do offer an online training tutorial, so it's a free online service that they can go through to receive the training. This is specifically dealing with the in-person training, we do all over the state.
Okay, we can follow up more about that offline unless anybody else wants to ask it, but I'm a little taken aback by that one. So, okay, thank you.
Let's go on to the next. So then number 10, administrative services reductions. So we would start paring down our executive HR business services divisions. And then the next few you'll see are elections related. I tried to keep the impact to elections towards the bottom. So 11 would be have a voter professional services and then keep going. 12 is eliminate the voters pamphlet. 13 is HAVA, OCVR, IT professional services. OCVR is the Central Voter Registration Database. And then the...
Can you go back one more, Mr. Taylor?
Yep.
Sorry. If you eliminate printing and distribution of the voters pamphlet, would you... it's online, right? The voters pamphlet is online?
Yes.
And is there a middle ground for that? I mean, is there a way to print a certain number and put them at public libraries or post offices so if people really wanted a, is it an all or nothing proposition?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, I think you could realize some savings if you did something less than mail it to every household. A lot of the expense, though, is the upfront expense of producing it in
okay.
the first place.
All right. Thank you very much.
The last one is eliminate some IT professional support that helps run the rest of the division. So those are our 10% reductions.
Great. Representative Nathanson.
Can we back up to the previous one, the pamphlet, voter pamphlet? This says printing and distribution. Madam Chair, I think what I heard in response, though, was that much of the cost is the upfront production, which is, I guess, compiling it and preparing it. And if it were to be online or even online only, we'd still have to compile it into a usable format. So I'm not clear on how we achieve that much savings without it being almost exclusively in the mailing costs if we're going to have to compile it and prepare it anyway.
It's the printing and mailing are the two big expenses above and beyond the internal staff time that we already used to produce it and bring it online.
Because formatting is different for a printed volume than for an online presence, or not?
It can be. It can be, and getting it to be
okay.
able to
print.
Well, Mr. Bender,
can I follow?
Yeah, sorry.
It can be, but it doesn't have to be. If we're talking about minimizing expense.
Right.
Could you please clarify if the committee did make this $703,000 reduction, would you still be able to have a voter's pamphlet just online, or would this be elimination of the voter's pamphlet, or just elimination of a printed version?
I believe this would just be the elimination of the printed version that we mailed every household.
Okay, so
the
there
state.
Would still be a voter's pamphlet.
We would have a voter's pamphlet online. I do want to say it is a maybe this is just me, but the voters pamphlet has a very special place, I think, in our heart and in the hearts of Oregon voters and citizens. It does go to every household in the state. It is the indication of the election season, and I know a lot of folks like to sit down at their kitchen table and read it. But, and a lot of folks do have access online. A lot of folks don't.
Okay. Representative Nathanson, one last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this before, and some of these same issues and questions and comments came up in the previous session. Have we ever received an alternative suggestion, which is instead of completely eliminating the printed version, the middle ground approach? Could we save $200,000, for example, or $500,000 by preparing a certain number of printed copies and making them available, as the co-chair just asked? When can we expect to get some alternative recommendation to consider?
If the committee would like to request that alternative recommendation, that's something we could certainly look at.
If Representative Nathanson's okay with this, maybe my co-chair and I will start to look at our overall budget box and start to figure out where we have to make cuts and what we should do. And once we know that, if we think that's one of the things that may be on the table, then we'll have a separate conversation with you, Mr. Taylor, and with Mr. Williams to get a clearer sense of how we might be able to find some middle ground on that and get a little bit better understanding of what the breakdown of that $704,000 is. Is that reasonable?
That's great.
Great. Representative Kahn.
Just a brief comment, Madam Chair. I live in a high poverty district, and I can't tell you how many of those voter pamphlet statements are in the big blue recycling tub when they come. I mean, maybe it's the difference of somebody that's, I don't know.
Even before the election, huh?
Are you kidding? Yeah, our recycling box is just huge in the post office, and it's like, I question the validity of how many people really do sit down and read them. And maybe it's because, like I say, the lack of educational professionals in my district, but it's pretty shocking.
It's useful information. Thank you, Representative. Okay, any closing remarks, Mr. Taylor, before we wrap up?
No, thank you so much for letting us appear.
Thank you. Committee, anything else? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on the Secretary of State's office, and unless there's any other business for the committee, we're adjourned. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you.